was wondering what theme to explore this evening with you, and I considered a few possibilities that actually just come from teaching two retreats. One of them was on the theme last weekend of the judgmental mind, which I've taught on here. Most of you have worked out those issues, so there's not a need for me to come back and teach further on that concern. And I had also been teaching with Oren Sofer, who has often taught here, on the theme of skillful speech. And I considered, since it's very alive and fresh, to talk on that theme. But I decided on something else, and I was thinking about what to explore. And I was thinking that in many ways this is like a home community, because I teach here about 10 times a year. And as some of you know, I have come back fairly recently from being away quite a bit. I was actually in New Mexico for 2 weeks in May, and from the near the beginning of June till close to mid-July, I was in Israel and Palestine. And I was teaching there and traveling there. And I thought that I wanted to share some things about that trip. It's a little bit like coming home to a home community. And I wanted to share that. And I have done that at Spirit Rock also. So I think that at least two or three of you have heard some of my reflections on this. I think it's going to be a different talk than I've given, so don't worry. Very good. Oren and I were talking during our retreat. Do we mind hearing the same thing over if it's helpful? Not so much. But I think this will be different than what I did in Spirit Rock. I'm going to explore it in a few different ways, but I thought that's what felt kind of in my heart, like I wanted to share. Just to share some of that experience with you, framed in terms of Dharma themes. And I do have a bunch of photos which I brought. I was trying to see if there's some way to show them to you. I have my computer here, but I think the screen is a little too small. And so I think I'll just talk about the themes, the main themes that I wanted to bring up. And I don't know, perhaps we could see a few themes later, or I could refer you to. There's a place on the internet where you can look at the photos. Maybe that's a better solution. So I was invited by the Insight Meditation Association of Israel about 2 years ago, maybe longer, to come teach. And I put it off I was going to go last summer, but I put it off because, if you remember, I was at a sabbatical where I was working on my book on transforming the judgmental mind. And so I went to teach there. They invited me to teach three retreats and to give a number of talks, which I did. So I gave three retreats. One of them was on the theme that I have taught at Spirit Rock, on what I was mentioning earlier, the theme of what's sometimes called the three characteristics. Anicca, or impermanence. Dukkha, or usually translated as suffering. I like to translate it as reactivity. And then anatta, usually translated as not self. So I did a weekend retreat in Tel Aviv on that. And how many of you have actually been to Israel? Okay, so it looks like about four or five people. And then I also taught two retreats at a retreat center that is a rented facility on a former kibbutz in the north near the Sea of Galilee. So, of course, being there was always being in the land of both the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible. You know, being around the Sea of Galilee, it's something. You know, being, you know, where we did the retreat was at a kibbutz, which was like 5 miles away from a place called Megiddo. You know what Megiddo is? Some of you probably do. It's the place where the Battle of Armageddon is to be fought. So there I was, a few miles away from where the future battle of Armageddon would be. Right? And so, you know, the whole country is filled with these kind of references. You know, the retreat was also near this mountain called Mount Tabor, which, you know, some prophetess, you know, 2,700 years ago told Samuel, made a prophecy on that mountain that he would die in a certain period of time. Anyway, so I was filled with that. So we did two retreats at this retreat center that was in the north near the Sea of Galilee, and one was a more standard retreat, insight practice, quite similar to the way it would be done here, insight meditation with a strong emphasis on the heart practices, 6 days, I co-taught it. They had me do most of the teaching. I had two co-teachers, Israeli. They had me give 6 of the 7 talks. It was okay. That had about 55 people. Another retreat had about 80. That was on the theme of engaged practice, on connecting inner practice with bringing it out into the world, including to social issues, of which there are some in Israel. Maybe more than some. Right. And so, and I also traveled around to different parts in the north and visited communities. I was hosted just magnificently. There was so much warmth and friendliness and graciousness. Being in people's homes, people drove me places. You know, one person drove me from Tel Aviv to the Dead Sea and to a place called Masada. Some of you know that in terms of the history, a place where Jewish rebels held out for a long time against the Roman Empire and eventually were about to be conquered, living on this mesa in the desert about 1,000 feet above the Dead Sea, and they committed mass suicide, you know. I think it was about the year 73. Some of you know that history. So, and also went to Jerusalem 3 times. You know, went to the Western Wall, went to the Christian church called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is supposedly at the exact place where Jesus was crucified, and also supposedly where Adam, of Adam and Eve fame, is buried. So, you know, everything is so close there. You have major holy places. This is the most holy place for Christians in the world. You have the Western Wall, which is the western, one of the walls of the temple, which was destroyed by the Romans within about, 50 yards of that church. And then another 50 yards away, you have the third holiest site in Islam called the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is recently in the news. Some of you probably followed that because there was violence around there and a lot of demonstrations. And anyway, so that gives you a sense. And I've been in some other places as well. Visited the Palestinian territories twice. And I'll come back to that. That was quite sad in many ways. So the themes I wanted to look at were themes which actually presented themselves almost immediately when I was on coming there. And these are Dharma themes. I really want to connect this to Dharma themes that are also about our practice, about how we work with things. And I think I want to look at 3 questions, really. And they were both in a strong way there for me near the beginning of the trip. Right, very soon after, within a day or two of being there, there were 3 strong areas of insight, question, application to practice. Then the first one was around questions of identity. That I was there and I met so many people immediately, virtually all of them that I met initially shared my own ancestry. Namely, being of Jewish background from Eastern Europe and coming and leaving those places under duress. You know, my ancestors certainly did that. But the Dharma question really is, what's the place of our identity, ethnic identity, other aspects of identity in the context of Dharma practice, right? What is that? You know, how do we make sense of there? You know, I certainly felt a very strong pull in many ways of the, in terms of the ancestry, and you know, just meeting people, feeling connected, sharing the same, a lot of the same stories, right? Like my grandparents all left Eastern Europe; they came to the U.S. Some of my other ancestors from the same area, some of them went to South Africa, some of them went to Argentina. I think some of them went to Israel, although I could not track them down right on this trip. And so there was this strong sense of connect. Many people from the same place where all of my, two of my grandparents came from Lithuania. Two of them were from a place called Vilna, Vilnius in Lithuania. And I actually found out, I went to a place which had these large databases for looking up ancestry and explored, and actually didn't find any new information, but it was very interesting. And but along the way, I think from different communications, I located all these people who had actually had similar ancestry who were in different parts of the world. Do you know who else came from this place called Vilna in Lithuania, which was said to be was one of the centers of Jewish life. It's said to be the Jerusalem of Lithuania. And I visited there twice. I actually did teaching there about 25 years ago and visited there first time when it was still a part of the Soviet Union. But I found out, you know who comes from the same ancestries? I didn't know all this. Bob Dylan? Or part of his ancestry. In fact, at a Tel Aviv museum, I went to, they had an exhibit on Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan at 75, and they emphasized some of his Jewish background. You know, Bob Dylan, Leonard Cohen, Nadine Gordimer, Amos Oz, the writer, J.D. Salinger, John Stewart. I didn't know all that. Scarlett Johansson, Emma Goldman, Aaron Copland, Michael Bloomberg, Menachem Begin, and Benjamin Netanyahu, the president, I guess prime minister. Anyway, so there was something very strong there, feeling a lot of similar history and feeling very connected, and you know, made me wonder. Maybe we can talk about this. How this is significant for you? How do you make sense of the Buddhist teaching of anatta? Right? The teaching of not-self. I think we've explored that some here. And where does our sense of ethnic identity, family, how as lay practitioners do we work with these teachings in the context of identity? It's a whole set of, how do you do that? Right? What's the importance of your ethnic identity? And for some people, the ethnic identity is somewhat lost. You know, I was in a group about 3 years ago at the East Bay Meditation Center for people who are quote unquote white. And you know, that has meant different things to different people, and it's a shifting concept, you know, and in 100 years ago, for example, Jewish people were generally not seen as white. In fact, you can look back and see there were racial systems there which had Jews as distinct races, even people from Italy as distinct races. And the true white people were Anglo-Saxons. Even 100 years ago, Swedish people, who we might think of with blonde hair and so forth as paradigmatically white, they were not white. They were problematic, right? There were, you know, for certain people, it was the Anglo-Saxon center. So it's a very strange history if you want to read about it. You know, it's a very strange history with massive amounts of craziness and delusion and projection and all sorts of things. But And so it's a shifting notion. But anyway, I was raising that because in this group, and I think it's actually very important to look at issues of ethnicity, whiteness, race in a Dharma context. But we did this, and virtually all of the other people in our small group, in the small group I was part of, saw themselves, these were people who were white, saw themselves in a way as mongrels. They couldn't really identify very well any particular identity, and in some ways they didn't have one. And there was suffering connected with that. There was a sense of not being, you know, not knowing in a sense deeply where they come from. Maybe they could know factually. And I felt quite different, right? Because I could feel a connection maybe going back 3,000 years, right? And actually, a difficult history in many ways, but also a lot of beautiful dimensions to it. And so that's interesting. Like, what do you find? How do you square that sense of not self as a layperson? I think, you know, a lot of issues here. I mean, we've been looking at it. There's very interesting material when we look at what's happening in the interface between psychology and meditation. You know, how do you see it? You know, what does not self mean to you? How do you understand your identity as, in terms of ethnicity or family or even your work, your vocation? Are there ways, you know, it seems like what the teachings are getting at certainly is pointing to the possibility of going beyond a limited identity. You know, certainly the teachings point to awakening, and even something like we're looking at in practice and retreats, of awakened awareness, which in a sense goes beyond that more narrow sense of identity. Is a very large identity that we point to in our practice of really in a sense identifying with all of being, not just human beings as well, but with all of being. That's where this practice goes, right? And what do we do on the way to that, right? What's that place of other kinds of identities? How do we hold it? Clearly, the traditional teachings are pointing to the problems of grasping. And we certainly know what the issues are in terms of grasping at identity, right? We know the issues of tribal warfare. We certainly know those issues. And so we can certainly point out a lot of problems that can be there with a more narrow sense of identity. But is there a healthy way to connect with one's own history and to know that? And let's come back to that. I want to make the timing work so I can ask you how you've looked at this. How do you see that? How do you understand this teaching of not self in the context of exploring identity? For me, very strong sense, and I loved, I felt myself very drawn to going at times to museums. There's a beautiful museum in Jerusalem called the Israel Museum, kind of totally world-class museum that has amazing material, archaeology going back probably 5,000 years, maybe more, and vast amounts of historical materials of all sorts. I also went to Yad Vashem, which is the museum of the Holocaust, right? And actually went to a second museum related to the Holocaust in the north, connected with the kibbutz. And so, I found myself very drawn just to know more. I mean, I've known, and studied a fair amount in the past, but there was something very powerful about being there, which is one of the understandings of Israel as the homeland of the Jewish people. Right? And that obviously has a lot of problematic aspects, but it also has some very beautiful aspects. Right? And so let's come back to that. How do you understand identity? You know, for the Buddha, it was very clear that you, in a sense, you join the Sangha as a monk or nun, and you essentially give up all your other identities. You know, that's very clear. You know, you go into the homeless life, you give up your home, you really don't particularly have connection with your family necessarily. In practice, I think it looks a little different, but certainly in the tradition, it seems like that. You know, you really leave those aspects of identity behind for the purposes of liberation. How do we understand that? Particularly as being at a historical time when there's so much focus on the individual. There wasn't that kind of focus in the same way, obviously, 2600 years ago. We live in this individualistic culture which has its pros and cons, obviously. But there's a lot of emphasis on the individual, individuation, becoming someone, having a sense of yourself. How does that square with our practice? Okay, so there are four or five different aspects of that. Interesting issues, interesting, important questions. So that's one area. A second area that was there, again, from the beginning. So right at the beginning, I have this first sense, gosh, this is, there are people who are from my own tribe, from my own background and so forth. And of course, I've experienced that a lot in the past. Of course, with family and so forth. I was not raised religiously. My parents both more or less rebelled against organized religious Judaism as teenagers, so I was not raised that way. I was raised to be sort of a secularly minded, scientifically minded, political left-wing progressive. A lot of 20th century Judaism looks like that. Still does, often. In any case, the second sense that I had on being there, almost right from the beginning, right after that sense of, I am really connected, you know, in a sense, these are my people, right, in a certain way. Right, almost immediately right after that was a sense of, this is a really hard situation. You know, these are my people, and, you know, they are in a really rough situation with this intense unresolved conflict with the Palestinians. It's intense, it's, you know, connected with violence elsewhere in the world. If there would be healing between Israelis and Palestinians, or between Jewish Israelis and Palestinians, whether Israeli or non-Israeli, because it's complicated. I just realized in saying that there are a lot of complications. There are 20% of the Israeli population are Palestinians, people who did not leave in 1948 for various reasons. And about 40% of the population share my ancestry, and about 40% have ancestry from North Africa or Iraq, Iran. People who, some of whom had been living in the land we now call Israel, Palestine, for generations, some of whom came in the more recent period, particularly after the establishment of Israel and the hostility in many Arab North African countries to Jews, including a lot of violence. So coming, you know, after the 1967 war and so forth. So that's so a lot of complexities there. And the as many of you know, the Palestinian territories are parts of former Palestine, which are, I think, I forget the percentage of the former land, but it's quite a large percentage of the land. And it's, they are, you know, many millions of people, and they are essentially living in very oppressive conditions. You know, and I visited and I saw that, you know, and there were, you know, I visited a village in the Palestinian territories called Walaje, you know, and was invited into a home. I went there with an Israeli activist who speaks Arabic, and he had a lot of contacts, as did many of the people I met there. I met a lot with people who were engaged in connections with Palestinians. There are a large, you know, there are a certain number of Israelis who are really consciously trying to deal with the situation. So I went there and shared the breaking of the Ramadan fast one of the evenings in a village. And we were very graciously welcomed, very beautiful. Right. And also went around East Jerusalem and saw just, you know, and it was again being led by my friend Aviv Tatarsky, who just knew all the details of life there and could tell me, just learned endless details of essentially oppression. It made me think of Jim Crow South, you know, 1920, Mississippi. It wasn't like that in many ways, but it had, a comparable level of oppression. You know, there were garbage everywhere, lack of equal municipal services, people couldn't get housing permits very easily. Houses were at risk because of that, of being demolished. If the Israeli government said, you had a stone thrower from your family, we'll demolish your house. You know, just lack of jobs, lack of adequate municipal resources. Really sad. Seems so unnecessary in some way. It was there. There were 50 things like that that I heard. You know, just one thing after another. Lack of ability to vote in the larger elections and so forth, and a lot of complications. So the second question was how do I understand and work with this really challenging situation? How do I understand it? How can I come? And I wanted to come from a place of empathy and understanding. How do I come from a place of empathy and understanding towards understanding this really difficult situation, right? And for me, I had to really use the lens of seeing that these are really two traumatized people. It's a really difficult situation, you know. Here it is, Jewish people have had, close to 2,000 years of oppression, being outside, being kicked out of where they were living, not having a homeland, being in many places oppressed, constant violence, and then you have, on top of that, then you have the Holocaust. And they have nowhere to go, they can't really go back where they were, and there is this possibility, which is supported by some of the great imperial powers, of going back to the area that was called Palestine at that time. And yet, partly because of the European racism, I think there was a tendency not to see the Palestinians as mattering so much, you know, at that time. But it's a very hard situation, because here they are. You know, one way of talking about it that I heard was the Jews jumped out of a burning building in Europe and landed on the Palestinians. Right, and so you can have really empathy and understanding for both sides, right? Here are these people, you know, about a quarter of the people I talked to, when they traced their ancestries, they went right back to the Holocaust, and then they knew people who were lost, right? And then you have, you know, 1948, the Palestinians flee most of the villages, not all, but most of them. Sometimes out of fear of violence, there were massacres, and just this really rough situation. And then there are a lot of complexities, but how can I, for me, I want to understand that with empathy and understanding and a sense of what might be a way of healing. How do we do that with a challenging situation like that? You know, how do we work with that? And really the connected thought, I mentioned there were three thoughts I had. The first was, these are my people. The second was, my people are in a pickle. And the third was, look at how many people are just going about their daily lives and normalizing an abnormal situation, in a way. Right? Normalizing an abnormal situation. And then I had to immediately ask, how do I do that? How do I, in some ways, normalize or take for granted an abnormal situation or a situation involving suffering? how do we do that? You know, how do we do that? And my mind went, you could go in a few directions. My mind went especially to the relation with African Americans. You know, and the unresolved trauma of slavery, Jim Crow, and the aftermath, which is still far, far, far from resolved, isn't it? Right? I mean, I could also go to climate issues, you know, or I could go to a number of different other areas. You know, for me, my mind goes especially to race and to climate issues. How much do we normalize? And, you know, everyone there, you know, it's understandable just going about living their lives. And what? And do we have a special responsibility as Dharma practitioners to attend to unresolved suffering? To attend to the suffering that's there, unresolved from the past, from past trauma, and to the threat of something like climate issues, you know? I don't need to say much, I'm sure, here, but I know there was a study released just in the last week which said that the chance of avoiding catastrophic problems is close to zero now, particularly, you know, again, that I think the people who are calculating it, you know, they found that the move by the United States out of the Paris Accords were quite significant, right? And so how do we relate to that? How do we relate to past trauma, future suffering? How do we do that as Dharma practitioners? What's our responsibility? You know, there's certainly a place for finding personal peace, living ethically, living with integrity. What do we do with these unresolved issues? And these were difficult issues for the Dharma practitioners in Israel. You know? In fact, some of the people who came to a retreat, which was supposed to be on engaged practice, didn't realize what they were getting into. And we had 90 people originally. Within about a day, 10 of them left. They didn't want to go into it. They came for peace and silence, right? They didn't want to look into this. So I think it's partly a matter of how do we understand these different situations. I'm realizing we're going into the hard stuff, right? Okay, Middle East, racism, climate issues, you know. We might start with, you know, local trash pickup issues, right? These determine our past, our present, our future. What's our responsibility as Dharma practitioners? I know a lot of you are thinking a lot about this more and more since the election, right? What's my role? What can I do? And I don't mean by talking about the big issues to make it feel like too much. I think it's very important to have a sense of here are concrete steps and actions that I can take. I think that was a problem in Israel, that people that I talked to often thought that they would say it's hopeless. It's too much. I heard that a lot. And I also met with people, not that many people, but I met with groups. Some of them were helping me co-teach this retreat for 80 people in engaged practice. And some of them were there at the retreat. And then I also met people who were in a group called Engaged Dharma. And they were doing wonderful projects. They were going into Palestinian villages and doing collaborative projects such as sharing in the harvesting of the olive crops. Sometimes it would be more resistance if the Palestinian village told them that they were getting harassed by settlers, by Jewish settlers. They would come to the situation and help in certain ways or draw attention politically to what was happening. Or one time there were water shortages. And again, their unequal distribution of resources between the occupied territories and Israel, and they would help with that. So they found they weren't operating with the big things, like how do we, you know, work with peace talks, or I don't know if that's the big thing, but it could be seen that way. They're working with small projects, building relationships, making connections, helping in small ways. And that, you know, that's not easy to do when you see the big picture not seeming to change. So I think that's relevant for all of us with good hearts. How do we, what's our part of the puzzle? How do we address that? So Maybe I'll stop there with those three kind of Dharma questions. First is about identity, and the second is really understanding this difficult situations, painful situations from the past. Again, I like to understand the situation there as two traumatized people and all both having intergenerational trauma. And again, intergenerational trauma makes it virtually impossible to be in the present moment. You know, when the stimulus connected with the trauma is there. When the stimulus connected with the trauma is there, one is, as it were, caught in loops of the past. Caught in loops of the past, activated, vigilant, thinking that the past pain will repeat itself. And one can't be in the present moment, be creative, fresh. And I interpret so much of what's happening as two peoples interacting with each other, caught in past pain. And so that would, you know, in that light, sort of a combination of trauma work and Dharma is extremely helpful. You know, and interestingly, in Israel, there's a higher per capita percentage of people doing Dharma practice than there is in the U.S. Just 8 million people, but the retreats were full. You know, they were full, and there's so many interested people. Some had Jewish identity. There's a very large secular population in Israel. You know, Tel Aviv, if you haven't been there, it is hip. It is not religious for the most part. In the synagogue there, it is hip. Really good vegan cuisine, you know. And so forth. So it's that second question of how do we understand suffering? And third, you know, what's our responsibility? That's again what came to me. You know, how do I normalize abnormal situations? And how might I respond to these major issues in my own life? And what are my tendencies to not deal with them? So these are not easy questions, but they're important ones. And so I'll stop and maybe just invite a moment of silence, then we can talk together. Thank you. Any comments, questions, and do we use the mic? Should we do that? And could be again about any of those questions. Maybe let me just direct this a little bit and say maybe to talk initially about identity. That might be a little more accessible, manageable issue. Anyone have ideas? What does identity mean to you? How do you square your sense of identity with Dharma practice, teachings of not self? Anyone have thoughts that you want to follow on that question?
Yeah. Well, the word that came to my mind when I was listening to you speak, and thank you for this, was othering.
Yeah.
That if I'm steeped in my own position as a member of a group, then there's me and my people and those others.
Yeah.
And if I drop away from that and I see that we're all the clan of humans,
right,
then it some of the walls have to come down.
Right. That seems so crucial. Yeah. That clearly the Buddha was concerned about grasping. Right. Again, we all know very well what tribal wars look like, tribal conflicts. We know what othering looks like. We know what that lack of ability to see everyone as part of the human family, we know what that looks like. Very familiar. And of course, it's still happening very much. And some of it's, you know, some of it's in our conditioning. We have, you know, some we have to even consciously work through that. But I think what you're pointing to is that sense of, can we understand identity and tendencies to create others? And can we also affirm a more universal identity as humans, and certainly what Dharma practice does, even as awakened humans, right? And how do we do that? And what's, you know, and what comes up when we try to do that?
And there's even the issue, just as you were saying it, I'm thinking...
Close to your mouth.
Oh, I'm thinking, okay, I'm awakened, but what about you?
Yeah.
You know, there's like, you know what I'm saying? There's just, again, that setting up a kind of a comparison, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Ways that we get in some ways attached to our own identity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Please, Lisa. In the back and then on the side.
Yeah. And I've got to grab another battery.
Is the battery getting low? Okay.
I'm just going to describe an experience that I have. Little background, I was born and raised in the Sayulita South Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Israel in 2012, and we were driving on the highway between Jerusalem north to the Sea of Galilee.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at a gas station to get gas, and there were a number of young Palestinian men just kind of hanging around, you know, and started to look at us. My partner and I. So we kept driving further north and came to a checkpoint. We were welcomed into Israel at the checkpoint, which was kind of funny because we didn't really know what it was all about. But my experience was that the tension that I felt at the service station was the very same. The very same
kind of tension that I felt growing up in the segregated South.
Mm.
It was visceral. It was deep. It was very, very intense.
Yeah.
And I couldn't really put my finger on it until I got back.
Yeah.
And I realized what had happened. And, you know, in the South, identity was pretty obvious. You had African Americans and you had whites.
Yeah.
But in Israel, it's not so obvious because many Palestinians look like Israeli,
and many Israeli look like Palestinians. So there's, if you're not from that particular country, you can't tell the difference.
But well, yeah. So, I mean, it's partly a matter of what you look like, but it's mostly a matter of where you live.
Exactly. You know, yeah.
A lot of it. I mean, like again, there are Palestinian Israelis who mostly live in mostly Palestinian cities and villages. One of the things that surprised me was the relative lack of interaction. And something like intermarriage is almost unheard of there. That surprised me. I found that out. You know, and I heard stories of, you know, there's interaction in some places. Like in Jerusalem, one of the areas where there's a lot of interaction is in the hospitals. The medical staff is like 50-50. And a lot of collaboration. I heard of one young couple, Palestinian young man and a Jewish young woman. They were going to get married. There were death threats against the young man. So it's, yeah. So like you say, like, and my mind did go to the Jim Crow South. The oppression was raw, it was clear, it was unambiguous, unequal treatment on, you know, 50, 100 different levels. And yeah, and nonetheless, I mean, people are still friendly. I had, you know, when I was going around East Jerusalem, well, we were invited very warmly into the Palestinian home. So again, it's a matter of when they know you, it's one thing, but when there's just the projection onto, oh, you are a member of this group, that's another matter, right? But we had, you know, I was treated generally very, very friendly, in a very friendly way. So, but yeah, it's very thick, the, you know, the, you know, identity is clear. There are, you know, there are places of interaction. Some of the universities, there are, so there's more connection. You know. But it's the oppression is just really strong. You know. Please. Yeah.
Going back to the whole thing about identity.
Yeah.
One thing Philip, a distinction Philip makes is between being defined by something or being characterized by something.
Yeah.
If you're defined by your identity, then there's all this projecting and grasping.
Yeah.
If you're characterized, then you can use that identity as a means of connection.
Yeah.
Like it's, you have a common language with you. You know, that those experiences that you have together. And you can also use it to connect with other groups. I belong to this Christian church, and it burned very severely last fall, and we ended up having our services in a Jewish synagogue.
Yeah.
And at one point, this person who belonged to the synagogue had Christian couples and an Islamic couple and some Jewish couples all to dinner at her house.
Yeah.
And to have that sort of richness was wonderful.
Yeah.
But again, it's being that, making that distinction.
It's a nice, very helpful distinction. Yeah. Some way that we are grasping and limited. Yeah. And the defined could be either coming from the outside or coming from the inside, right? That definition. It could be I grasp onto it myself, or I've been conditioned to grasp onto it. I've been defined, you know, like that way. You know, defined by like whites and blacks in the deep south. You know, that was it was hard to get out of that system, right?
I am my whiteness.
Yeah, right. And that sense of this is part of me, but it's not the totality of me, this is part of me that has important aspects, but I can also go to that bigger, deeper, broader identity. And again, that's, I think, what our practice is very much pointing to the point that it gets really to be experienced, right? You know, so our metta practice, of so many of our practices point towards these expanded sense of connection across different differences, right?
It's not identifying with any of those things.
Yeah. Well, not identifying, no. See, what does that mean?
I think it means that you're not reducing yourself.
Yeah.
To that
this is not the totality of me.
Yeah, and you're not carrying it into all kinds of situations. It's something that comes and goes like everything else.
Yeah.
White skin, well, there it comes. I get a sunburn, there it goes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, whiteness is a strange identity.
Sure is.
That's right, and it, you know, it was constructed, you know, not so long ago. And you know.
But that's more of just these shards, these pieces.
Yeah.
That we somehow take to be some kind of essence.
Yeah.
I think that's what Buddhism addresses.
Yeah. Others in the back. Did you have your hand up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Patty. Okay.
I'm really glad you're addressing this because I was raised Jewish and everyone presumes that I want to go to Israel and that I should go to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I have family in Israel, I have friends in Israel. And for years I've been pressured to go to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I've resisted the pressure because I am so uncomfortable with that discomfort that you found there with how difficult the situation is. I see the analogy with the way our country began by decimating the Native Americans here. Israel began with people jumping out of a burning building onto the Palestinians. That's a great analogy. But I am so deeply uncomfortable with what, quote, my people did and the repercussions today that I don't know that I know how to behave if I had gone to Israel.
Right.
So I am so deeply disturbed by that I just stay away from Israel and study it from afar.
Mm-hmm.
And try to find a way to find peace in that. Also, before I ever discovered Buddhist practice, I loved the John Lennon song about Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And when I learned about not self, I identified with that song about just because my people came from a tradition of Judaism and came from Eastern Europe,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them settled in Israel and went through the Holocaust. A lot of them didn't survive the Holocaust, but those who did settled in Israel and in the United States. That song and Buddhist practice made me not want to identify too strongly with that tradition. Though the tradition itself focuses so much on identification. The holidays every year remind you if that's who you're supposed to identify with, if that's what you do. So I'm very torn around those issues about observing the cultural traditions and not taking too strong an identity in who those people have become and how we behaved in the past. So it's just really an interesting subject. I'm glad you brought up
very,
that discomfort.
Yeah, very interesting, and a lot of wonderful things that you say. And there's also, I think, with every tradition, every spiritual tradition, there are understandings that go beyond that limited identity. So I think of many aspects in Judaism, particularly the emphasis on justice, and then in some of the mystical traditions. One thing I didn't mention is that I visited the historical center of Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition in the north, called a place called Sfat. And I actually ended up meeting with several Kabbalistic rabbis. And but there, I think, in some, and you know, when you think of, if you know the history, you know that there are whole histories. Most of the history, Jews got along really fairly well with Muslims. And there's a long history. You go to a place like, I don't know, parts of North Africa and so forth, and you'd have Christian, Jewish, Muslim, wise people sharing their ideas, right? Or you'd see, if you read the poetry of Rumi, you see something like that, right? And a sense of the shared wisdom that is goes beyond any individual tradition. I think you can find that in the tradition. So, very poignant situation for you as well. And so, yeah, and I was thinking also, I think we're going to go in a moment to the meta cards. And we'll do those. We may have a little more time for talking together, but in terms of teaching on self and not self, there's a lot of complexities. It's not simple, and sometimes "not" is translated as "no self," which is a bad translation and suggests, I think, a very problematic interpretation. I like some of you know Thanissaro Bhikkhu. some of you know him, some of you like him very much. He has a very nice book called Selves and Not Selves, which come out of talks. And he has basically the view that the sense of self is very, very important for development, and for including spiritual development, that without a sense of self, how do you have a sense of ethical responsibility, accountability? Right, and so forth. And he says, in many, many ways, development requires a sense of self. Of course, we don't want to be too tight about it. That's your point, right? But there can be a sense of self, identity. Yes, I did that. That was me, etc. He says that's important for many parts of the training, but then there are parts of the training where one goes beyond that. And so I think I found that quite helpful to say that it's not an either-or matter, but it's one way is understanding it developmentally, which a lot of Western psychologists have come up with something somewhat similar, you know, that actually you can't really engage in Buddhist practice so well unless you have fairly healthy self-development first, right? If you don't, you have to go back and do some, and some people get confused and think that because, you know, they have actually may have some psychological issues where they don't have a well-developed sense of self. They say, okay, gosh, sounds like these texts. Oh, I'm there. And you know, I won't go further with that. So